From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Bordang, correspondent for the Times of London, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and our moderator is Shayna Estulin, Washington correspondent for I-24 News.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Shayna Estulin, and here are the issues we will be talking about. Impeachment. It was a historic day on Capitol Hill, as President Trump became only the third president in U.S. history to be impeached. But will it end up hurting the Democrats? And speaking of Democrats, another presidential debate, this time in L.A., with Mayor Pete Buttigieg on the defensive. And finally, terror in New Jersey, an anti-Semitic attack leaves a community reeling. All right, we've got a great panel to discuss this with. Bordang from the Times of London and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Tom, I'm going to start with you because I believe on your Twitter bio it says you've covered every administration since LBJ.
Yes, as a young intern at Newsweek, I actually went on my first trip with the president with LBJ in the summer of 68.
Okay, so you can give us the long view here when we're talking about impeachment, and that's the story we're going to start with. President Trump is now part of a club no president really wants to be part of, right?
It is an exclusive but a dubious exclusivity. He's now become the third president after Andrew Johnson in 1866 and Bill Clinton impeached. I remember that after Bill Clinton left office, he would often say, at least for a while, I am convinced that my impeachment will not be mentioned in the first paragraph of my obituary. He's wrong about that, and President Trump is wrong also. It is a stain. It is a sting, and you can spin it however you want. You can blame partisans from the other party, but it is a very dubious distinction, and apparently President Trump is reeling below the scenes, as well he might. I mean, it's not a good thing to have on your resume, and he has said to aides that he's worried that this will detract from some of the things that he very strongly feels that he has done in a positive way. We'll see.
Right, and he sort of sells himself as the best president, the greatest president that ever lived, and this impeachment basically says the opposite of that. Boer, just to remind everyone, impeachment does not mean a president is kicked out of office. There's another step before we get there, obviously a Senate trial, but the Democrats seem to be delaying that from happening. Why is that?
Yeah, you're exactly right. There's certainly going to be more operatics to come, I think.
You mean in political theater in Washington?
The political theater that is Washington. And as you mentioned, so Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, and who I think this impeachment will be a part of her legacy as much as it is Trump's, going sort of the other way, and that she sort of got the House to do this historic move against an unpopular president. But there is a fear that it may be a bit of a Pyrrhic victory, given that Republicans control the Senate, where you need a two-thirds majority vote to actually remove the president. The majority has sort of indicated in the Senate that there really isn't going to be much movement in that direction. Mitch McConnell, the Senate majority leader, is quite a formidable foil to Ms. Pelosi, and he's said that he's going to take his cues from the White House. There may be three or four vulnerable Republican senators whose seats are up in 2020, but that's nowhere near the numbers you need to actually get him removed. And so now really comes the hard part. We always knew that Democrats had the numbers they needed in the House, a simple majority, to impeach the president on these two charges. But now there are very few cards that the Democrats can play. And I think Ms. Pelosi seems to be aware of that and is saying, well, what is the best way that I can get some concessions from the Senate to make sure that there's either time to get the American public on board or to get these senators on board. There's time to shape the trial, which will be, we expect, in January, to the best of her ability now that the articles are moving from the House that she controls to the chamber that Republicans will very much get to sort of have their say in.
Right. And what she's doing now, or she won't exactly say she's doing it, is holding up the transmitting the articles of impeachment from the House to the Senate, and in order to start the Senate trial, you need to have those articles of impeachment. Barr brought up a really good point, Tom, that McConnell's the ultimate foil to Nancy Pelosi. I mean, he's arguably the most powerful man in Washington, and he's made it very clear he wants to see the president acquitted. So that's really is that the end of the story for this whole thing?
Well, it's hard to see at this point how President person Trump has removed from office, barring some other bombshell, barring testimony from, say, a John Bolton, his former national security advisor, who is right in the middle of all of this Ukraine stuff. And I think that's part of the game. The Democrats would like to figure out a way to force the Senate Republicans to allow the testimony of certain individuals close to Trump. It's really only in the farce of Washington politics can you have a situation where the Republicans say impeachment is a hoax or a sham because it's all hearsay. And Democrats can point out, and in this situation they have a case, that maybe it's hearsay, maybe it's not hearsay, but the people who could give direct testimony have been banned by President Trump from testifying.
Right. Let's hear from those firsthand witnesses, right, which you're not letting us.
And Mitch McConnell, the Republican majority leader, has no interest in that, and neither does the White House. So we're heading towards a stalemate, I think, is what's going to happen. And they're both going to maneuver, but you have a majority leader, McConnell, who has said, I am not an impartial juror. The way these things work is it goes to the Senate, and the Senate, all 100 senators, have to swear an oath that they will be true and faithful to the Constitution and be impartial jurors. Well, McConnell has already said on the record, hey, I'm not an impartial juror.
But he's really just saying what everyone is saying quietly.
Right.
Nobody is an impartial juror. This is a political process.
Right.
It's not murder trial where you've got random jurors selected.
Right. Well, it is a constitutional deal, but it's a political process, and impeachment is inherently political. The Constitution says that you can be removed from office for treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors. I can remember when I was covering Vice President Gerald Ford in the 70s, he was always asked, what's the definition of impeachment? This was in the middle of the Nixon business. And he would always say, Gerald Ford would always say, impeachment is what a majority of the United States Senate decides it is.
I wonder, because you're going to be our international person, since you've got the accent, what is the international reaction to this? Because I think we just heard from Vladimir Putin, who sort of mocked the Democrats for what they were doing. Not a surprise there, but not really much from anyone else.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a British perspective, there's been an election there as well. And so everyone's sort of obsessed with what's going to happen next. But I think what's fascinating for me, looking at it from Washington, translating it for an international audience, is this is a problem for Democrats. It's just how inured Americans seem to be to this whole process. As I'm sure some of our listeners know, despite the fact that there have been weeks of this impeachment hearings, of debates over this, of this historic vote, the numbers for Trump remain stubbornly steady. A plurality of American voters, when they're polled, say that they support removal, but a plurality says, no, they back the president. And the degree to which the arguments that Republicans are making, which to foreigners sound quite strange, right? If you had a British politician who was seen to be doing something so dubious, there would certainly be public reaction. But the degree to which the Republican argument saying, well, it's not an actual crime, the aid to Ukraine, which Mr. Trump was alleged to have held up in exchange for this political dirt, was actually released, the degree to which that resonates with Americans seems to be much higher than you would expect. And I sort of suspect it's because, you know, most Americans in their day-to-day lives outside of Washington, this isn't affecting how they live. They're worried about things like healthcare and the economy and, you know, all these other things that will be election issues in 2020. And I suspect that sort of is part of the explanation, at least, for how little the political story seems to be impacting them.
That's a really good point. And Tom, I'm going to let you jump in a second. But that's my big question here is the 2020 election is about a year away. We're talking about how big a story this is, impeachment, only the third president to be impeached. But will voters care in a year from now?
Probably not, except for the most intense proponents and opponents. I think 10 and a half months from now, when the election happens, President Trump's core supporters will still be enraged and still be behind him on this. And a Democratic base of supporters who think he's probably the worst president in history, they will be just as intense. I think the worst part of this whole spectacle is, and I'm not going to offer an opinion on the merits, but the worst thing emotionally is that it just exacerbates the incredible polarization in the country right now. It's distressing, and it's the polarization is far worse than at any point in the presidencies of the last 10 presidents that I've covered. I just wanted to say very quickly, I got a message the other day from an old friend who was a military aide to Vice President Ford in the 70s. He's retired from the Navy. He lives in the suburbs of Chicago, and he just sent me a note. He's always been apolitical, and he just said, out here in the heartland, we care about the price of corn, and we care about the Green Bay Packers-Chicago Bears football game. And he said, the Democrats have just reelected Trump.
Wow.
Well, we'll see. We will see. I've said a million times from these microphones, overnight is a lifetime in politics, and we have 10 and a half months worth of lifetimes to go, so remains to be seen.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I covered this on Capitol Hill, and it felt like the day after impeachment, it was almost as if Washington was hungover. It just felt so brutal the day before. But as you mentioned, people in the rest of the country, not on the coast, frankly, are not viewing it the same way. They just don't care as much. And that is a big question, Barr. Is this going to hurt the Democrats in the end? And I mean, when you hear the Republican argument here, this is a nothing story. The Democrats have been obsessed with impeachment from the beginning. They just found a reason now, an excuse now to impeach the president. Is that an argument that is working with voters?
I think certainly the question about the Democrats, that's something that they know and are quite well aware of, especially you have these 31 Democrats in the House who flipped districts that Trump had won in 2016 in the last midterm election, who have publicly acknowledged, saying, look, we know that our jobs are on the line, but we feel that protecting the Constitution, doing what we think is our duty, is the right thing. But there's also at least one Democrat who's switched parties because of this impeachment. And so the nervousness is palpable. The centrists are the ones who are most at risk going into 2020. And I think to Tom's point earlier, the sad sort of victim of all this is any sort of consensus politics, any kind of pitch to the center, kind of gets destroyed.
Sure.
And you get more polarization. Yeah.
All right. On that note, and a good last note, let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion on impeachment and the debate as well. There's just so much more left to say. All right. We'll be back.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Gord Yang, correspondent for the Times of London. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. And our moderator, Shana Estulin, Washington correspondent for I-24 News.
Okay, we are back. I am Shana Stulen. We were talking about impeachment, and let's pivot to the day after impeachment. We had a debate, a Democratic debate in Los Angeles, 7 leading candidates there on the stage. Boer, what were your main takeaways from it?
It's funny, Tom and I were sort of talking a bit about it before the show, and we both sort of walked away thinking that it was certainly the strongest performance we've seen from the current front runner, Joe Biden. Whereas in previous debates, what viewers have tended to come away with, kind of his gaffe and things that he said that he probably shouldn't have. He had a really poignant moment in this particular debate that kind of goes on the theme we were talking about earlier when he talked about the need to have a call to bipartisanship, which I think was the right tone to hit the day after this really divisive vote. And he said, I have more reason than anyone to be angry with the Republicans, given that all they've done to tear down myself and my family, because as you know, the impeachment argument is that Mr. Trump alleges his son was engaged in, Mr. Biden's son was engaged in corruption in Ukraine. But he said, look, the truth is we have to be able to work together and we can't convince him. We have to win at the ballot box. And I think that was probably the strongest line that he's delivered over the course of the last several debates. It was an important moment, I think, for a number of the other candidates who have been struggling to make their voices heard and were able to do that a bit better on this stage where there were 7 candidates instead of a bigger field.
7,
yes, you've lost count. It was a good moment for Senator Klobuchar, who's a centrist from Minnesota, who really sort of made her pitch as the other strong centrist voice. There were actually some moments of humor, which was quite nice in what tends to be a bit of a slog in other debates. But, it was an important moment because it's the last debate of 2019. It's the last chance for a lot of these candidates to get a national airing before Iowa votes in about 7 weeks. It's the first state to cast primary votes. And it's also notable the people who weren't on the stage, most especially Mike Bloomberg, who is a late entrant into the race, who's running a very different campaign where he's not going after the early states, but it's always a question given the vast amounts of money.
Right, he can just throw away money at campaign ads and doesn't even have to get on that debate stage.
Exactly, so you're kind of wondering in the back of your mind, this is very interesting, but will the race sort of be thrown into tumult?
I think Bloomberg is gambling that Biden will falter and the party will say, oh my gosh, what are we going to do now?
And we need a centrist to save us.
A centrist zillionaire who can self-fund a campaign. And I think that's his calculation. But I do agree that Biden had a very strong performance, steady, stable, low-key. And Biden was trying to make the contrast between himself and, how shall we say it, a white-hot President Trump. I think that his tone was calibrated and calculated in that way. It was interesting to me that Mayor Buttigieg took a few torpedoes.
Yeah, that was the other thing I wanted to bring up. He really was on the defensive.
Notably there. By Senator Warren, which tells you she's reading the polls to see that some of her support has been siphoned away to Buttigieg. And so she beat him up on fundraising, which I thought was not particularly smart. She talked about a fundraiser that he recently had in what she called a wine cave with billionaires, and he was ready for that. And
he had a retort ready to go.
And the answer was that, Senator, you took tens of millions of dollars from your reelection campaign that you raised from the very same sort of people. And he talked about purity tests, and the most important thing, according to Buttigieg and others, was we got to stop bickering among ourselves and figure out how we beat President Trump, because that is has to be the bottom line for Democrats.
So, yeah, it's like the revolution eats its own. If the Democratic Party is so pure, can there ever be a candidate that can actually beat Trump, Tom?
No, I don't think so. But I think the purity test will stop at some point here, and that the progressive wing of the party is at some point is going to have to realize, and I think ultimately will realize that you've got to have a centrist, you've got to have a moderate to stand any chance against the juggernaut that is a sitting president with zillions of dollars in the bank.
Boer's itching to get in, but before you do, I just want to ask you something. You know, the Republicans say the Democrats are trying to impeach President Trump because the Democrats don't trust any of their candidates could actually beat him, and that's what we were talking about with Tom. Is there any truth to that?
I think there is, and I think, you know, to Tom's point about Mike Bloomberg coming in and saying Biden, there's not enough enthusiasm for him to win, and I think that dynamic is what you're seeing play out on the stage. I slightly disagree with what Tom said about...
Oh, good, we have a debate.
...the progressives coming around. I definitely agree. I think most of America is still sort of generally a center-right country. It has been in the past, and you need somebody who can work across the aisle, and especially after such a divisive presidency. But I think one of the fears for Democrats is that they haven't learned the lesson of 2016, when there was a lot of progressive, sort of more left-wing energy behind Bernie Sanders, who is sort of the go-big candidate. And this time we have two of them, Warren and Sanders. I feel like one of the reasons why you're still seeing so much energy behind them is that was never resolved. And this time around, the fear is that the energy is behind that wing of the party in the primaries, the people who come out and vote for the candidate, and it's different from the general electorate plebiscite, which is, you know, sort of more centrist, and you get a broader swath of the country. I think you're right that they'll come around and back the candidate that the Democrats eventually choose. But if there's not the enthusiasm to get them out to vote, that is a problem for the Democrats. And I think there is a wing of the party that says, you know what, I'm not going to vote for Joe Biden or a Pete Buttigieg or centrist.
That's also the problem of the way the system is set up, where you've got a primary first, and primary voters are often more extreme. They want a more extreme candidate. So to get through that process first, often you'll get a candidate that is more on the extreme that maybe the general public doesn't really want to vote for.
Well, the centrists have always said the problem with Warren is she's too toxic, because she's not just center-left, she's far left, and she allegedly, so the argument goes, is too shrill. I mean,
that code word for she's a lady?
Probably, but I think mainly it's because it's a code word for what Trump calls Pocahontas. She comes off as the avenging angel.
She's too angry.
Yeah, that's the right word. She's too angry, and she's too easy to caricature by President Trump as someone who wants to take away every hard-earned dollar you've won in the free enterprise system. And she comes on a little too strong, And that might be exactly what the Democrats need, but I think that's a real risk. I don't think Sanders will be the nominee. I don't think Warren will be the nominee. Some will say Biden and Warren would be a great ticket. We'll see.
Boer, again, I will remind everyone we're about a year or so, or 10 and a half months away from 2020. And you mentioned this is an important debate because it's the last debate of 2019. But at this point, when we're still so far away and so much can happen, do these debates even matter that much?
Yeah, I think that is a very legitimate question because, you know, the only people who are really watching these debates are people who are very engaged in Democratic politics. As we sort of alluded to earlier, those tend to be people who favor more left-wing candidates, where the energy of the party is. But as you say, it's a very long time until November. The viewership numbers for these kinds of debates are really not that high. I think what will be more interesting and matter more is sort of seeing how people actually caucus on the ground, how they are on the stump. And Pete Buttigieg's numbers in Iowa have been rising. He's now a front runner ahead of Biden, even in the latest poll from the state. And he clearly got the front runner treatment last night. So I think there's a pitch to a national audience, which may or may not matter. But there's also a pitch to sort of a local audience that may well matter, given that Iowa is coming up very soon.
Okay, so the last question on this subject, Tom, let's talk about Buttigieg. Let's talk about Iowa. How important is the Iowa caucus and the fact that he is the front runner when we're talking about
well,
that?
It's important, but mainly because it's the first. Winning the Iowa caucus is not tantamount to winning the nomination. Sometimes it happens. More often than not, it doesn't happen. But the Iowa caucuses, followed by the New Hampshire primary, are important because they're early tests of strength.
Right.
But they're not necessarily decisive. For instance, if Biden loses in Iowa and he loses in New Hampshire, that's not going to be good, but that doesn't mean his campaign has taken on lethal blows. But it's too early to tell.
But the cycle almost feeds itself, because if somebody loses the first couple of primary votes, then the coverage sort of changes, and then they become the weak candidate in everyone's eyes, and then maybe people don't vote for them,
donors don't open their pocketbooks as readily. Donors like somebody who looks like he or she is going to win.
Yeah, that's true. Let's end that there, and while I have you guys for a couple more minutes, I want to change to a story that came out of New Jersey last week. This really troubling, deadly anti-Semitic attack killed four people, including a police officer. Local officials and police believe this was an attack that was targeting Jews. Now you have a school board member in the state who's being called on to resign because she posted this like horrible attack against Jews in response to the shooting. What I want to focus on here is there's been a lot of criticism on the coverage of this attack, that it's not getting the same amount of coverage as other attacks on Jews because it wasn't white supremacists that did it. Tom, to you first, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's hard for me to know. In this day and age, it's depressing and dispiriting that you have anti-Semitic things like this continuing to happen. I think it's not gotten the coverage it deserves because of the Democratic debate and because of the impeachment frenzy. And now, of course, we're going into the holiday season, and we come back from the holidays and there's a State of the Union. That will be interesting to see when that happens. Is it before or after a Senate trial? And then you've got the Iowa caucus, New Hampshire primary. It has not gotten the attention it deserves. I don't think for any nefarious reasons, but that's just the way it works. But I think it's troubling. The whole rise of anger and the sense of grievance, the polarization of our political system has kind of aided and abetted wacko people. And it somehow gives them the legitimacy that they absolutely do not deserve. It's another example of the dark side of American politics, and it's troubling.
No, it's horrible. And of course, people that want gun control say it also happens to be because people have easier access to guns. Boer, you know, it's not just an issue, anti-Semitism, here in the United States. Unfortunately, it's all around the world. Europe is battling this. England, the UK is battling this as well. The speculation is Jeremy Corbyn lost the election so badly in part because he's battling his own issues with anti-Semitism. There is a connection here, it almost feels like.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think this, as Tom says, it's really sad and dispiriting that there's this sort of atmosphere of anti-Semitism prejudice that takes on a violent and really dark tone with really dark consequences. And you're absolutely right. Britain has just had a general election as well. And part of the reason why Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party did so badly was because, yeah, there were definitely people who were quite fed up with the way his leadership of Labour and his party has dealt with anti-Semitism within its ranks. The sort of backstory of it is that, you know, in Britain, just as in America, there are sort of divisions within constituencies, and there is a certain degree of prejudice among part of the constituency for Labour, and that just was not handled well. And, you know, it's just, hopefully we can move on to better times, and coverage of things like this certainly deserve to be seen.
Yeah, and as we wrap this show up, wishing everyone a safe and a happy holiday season. That is all the time we have. Thank you to Bo Ardeng, correspondent for the Times of London, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. This program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Shayna Estulin. Thanks for listening.